Hi, this is a lecture on poetry. A poem, according to the dry language of the dictionary, is a composition in verse, and verse is metrical writing, that is, writing concerned with the number and variety of accented and unaccented syllables. Perhaps a few hundred years ago, this might have made a barely passable definition, but it certainly doesn't work well in the 21st century. Even many traditionalists now acknowledge that poetry can be made in free verse, a composition not in metrical writing. The lines of free verse end where the poet feels they would be most effective ending, not when the required number of stressed and unstressed syllables are tallied up. Experimental writers push free verse so far that sometimes it almost seems to become a language other than the one it is written in. And if American poets are still uncertain about the issue, a prose poem, a composition that looks very much like a paragraph you'd read in a novel, has all the heightened, compressed, and figurative language found in poetry. So just to be clear, when I say prose, this usually refers to the ordinary language of writing and speaking. I know it gets tricky, but prose is what we call when you write an essay, or even when somebody is writing a novel, for example, that's not in verse. It's language that's not metered. It's language that's not treated as if it were poetry. And of course, this slips and slides in contemporary work. In fact, there are many novelists that write with very heightened language and very figurative language. So these are not always hard and fast rules. I think what distinguishes poetry has to do with meter or how the work looks on the page, the level of heightened speech, and other aspects of language and sonority and intimacy with the musicality of language that are unique to the poetic form. So when I say that prose is an ordinary language of writing and speaking, by no means do I take that to mean that it is merely ordinary, right? I'm only saying that it's not as heightened usually. So, and there are, we can discuss this later, but one day, because I think that, for example, the language of argument, the language of even speeches, can blur between poetry and prose. So I will continue. Does this mean that in poetry anything goes? Not exactly. But let me put it this way. In his poem, A Course in Creative Writing, a poem written by William Stafford, S-T-A-F-F-O-R-D. William Stafford says that most students want a wilderness with a map, a diagram of how to do things. But it can be difficult to even define poetry, let alone try to sketch out its terrain. So, sometimes it's best to talk about the poetic line and poetic forms that have existed in the past or some that are existing presently in order to apprehend the form. Short poems are significantly shorter than even the shortest of short stories, essays, and plays. So sometimes it makes it seemingly easy form to look at, but actually I think poetry is one of the hardest forms to access. And by this, I don't mean the act of difficulty. So I want to just think of this as a thought balloon. But the word difficulty sometimes gets bandied about in relationship to writing in a pejorative sense. You know, like something is difficult, therefore it's insurmountable, it's impossible, it's challenging in a way that makes you want to throw the book across the room. Throw the computer across the room. None of that is really true, although sometimes as a reader, you might have those feelings. I think the word difficult is actually very beautiful. And what I mean by that is that language that is powerful, that for a reader, from the reader's point of view, where you have to do some work, right? When you have to have some engagement with the material and actually sit with it longer than 6 minutes, 5, 3 minutes, right? Difficult language, difficult texts demand more contemplation. And they ask you sometimes to parse through more complex ideas. I'm not going to set up a binary here around what is difficult and what is easy, because I think in writing and in literature, that's a very false binary. But what I will say is that sometimes that word difficult is used to shove away, shove aside, alienate writing. And maybe make a reader feel, and this is a common feeling, I think, maybe make a reader feel inadequate. Like, I don't get it. I don't, why, it's so hard. It's not made for me, right? And I think that the thing about writing is that it's another space. So it's not an everyday space, actually. It may resemble the everyday on its outside, but literature, writing, artful writing, that's not like a grocery list or something terribly mundane, really occupies what I call another realm, the realm of art, right? So in the realm of art, we're walking into, as readers, as audiences, as viewers, etc., into another space. And that space may or may not resemble the world we know on an immediate level. It may have different rules of operating, right? Or sometimes it may resemble rules that we are familiar with. And it asks us to contemplate, to be with something. Art demands attention and contemplation. In a way, I think, and this, well, we can argue about this, but in a way, it's not, you're not meant to get it at first glance. Because that's not a real invitation, is it? The real invitation is when you're asked to kind of walk into something. Now, some art makers, writers, poets, fiction writers, other kinds of writers, visual writers, and this world, the world of visual writing, I include graphic novelists, filmmakers, right? People who work with visual mediums. Although text on a page is a visual medium. Some writers want to grab you right away. So sometimes they use techniques that feel immediate, right? That feel immediately recognizable, quote, easy. And then through that, they kind of hook you. And then through that, they actually demand of you to kind of sit with complicated ideas. So I just wanted to throw that out. I know it's just a lecture, but I know it's something that is debated in the field a great deal, the field of writing, the field of art. And that sometimes doesn't trickle down to people thinking about writing or writers themselves. So I just wanted to mention it right away. You can look at poetry from various angles and, of course, break it down into its component parts. But at the end of the day, the drive to make a poem sometimes doesn't have a map, right? So go back to this idea of William Stafford's, who says most students want a wilderness with a map. And what I'm advocating is that actually you just need to get lost in the wilderness and make your way without a map. sometimes, because that path can lead you to wonderful revelations. So in a way, this is aligned to the idea of difficulty, right? You're getting lost in the forest. Get lost in the forest because you have to find your way. Writing that makes you find your way. Writing that you write, writing that you read, where you have to do some work, where you have to figure out what the map is, can lead you to revelation. One of the pleasures of writing poetry is that it offers frequent surprises. You never know when you're going to say something you didn't know you knew, or say something you didn't think could be said. Even someone like Robert Frost, right? Super famous poet from the 20th century, found the process a constant adventure. This is something that Robert Frost said. "I have never started a poem yet whose ending I knew. Writing a poem is discovering." Most good poems contain some element of the unexpected. A poem that's overdetermined from the start, one in which the poet can see the beginning, middle, and end, will probably arrive dead on the page. And nothing kills a poem faster than cliché, whether it's an overused phrase or a formulaic structure with a predictable conclusion. So a sidebar here, I would say this applies not just to poetry, but it also applies to fiction writing, short story writing, novel writing, and even the writing of plays and screenplays and dramatic writing. Nothing kills writing faster than a cliché, whether it's an overused phrase or a formulaic structure with a predictable conclusion. Now, novelists often create an outline before they start to write. This has to do a lot with the size of the task, right? So when you're writing a novel, if you're so inclined, it's kind of like a different way of organizing your data, right? So novels take years to write often. Sometimes people write them in a month. Right, they do that, you know, NaNoWriMo thing. But often, if you talk to novelists, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, I labored over this, and it's a different kind of speed of writing. Novels take time. You're doing long form writing, really super long form, right? Plots and subplots, and you're handling sometimes a lot of characters, different kinds of situations. So in a sense, to write a novel, you actually do need an outline, because it's hard to keep all of that in your head. It just is. And some novelists work differently. You know, some of them write out their outline. Some of them put post-it notes, you know, above their computer on the wall and sort of map it out that way. And that becomes their outline, right? So there's no hard and fast rule about this. Poems usually begin with an idea, a phrase, an image, or a hunch, right? You just have a hunch about something and you start writing. Rarely do poems start with an outline. So if you find yourself writing poetry or thinking about poetry, reading poetry, think of it that way. I'm thinking about Amanda Gorman's speech at the inauguration of Joseph Biden. And, you know, she, in some interviews, she's talked about the process of rewriting, right? That she was writing and she was also like knowing the pressure. That's a very unusual thing, right? Knowing the pressure, you're going to do a global performance on a historic day. You know, for a poet, that's a pretty tall order, right? That's not like doing a poem at open mic night. You know, that's like really, it suddenly has different kind of responsibility behind it. That said, you still have to work on the work, right? So, and she's talked in different interviews about process of revision with that poem and just trying to get it absolutely right, knowing that, while at the same time feeling very free in terms of wanting to say what she had to say, but also knowing that historic moment, She's speaking to a country at a very specific time, and making sure that the words mattered, right? Word mattered and counted and would communicate to a large crowd, right? Which is a very different thing than you're writing it down in a notebook, or you're going to write it in a small book and you don't know who your audience is. So sometimes, often, I think, knowing where your audience is affects how you make things, right? That's just a normal thing. And that's true for poetry as well, even when you write it with an idea, a phrase, a hunch, or an image. Now, it may be that the word hunch is simply another word for inspiration. John Keats, super famous poet from long ago, long, long ago, famously wrote that if poetry come not as naturally as the leaves to a tree, it had better not come at all. I think he was maybe being a little bit cheeky with that, but I think he was talking about the idea of when a poem, a piece of writing, courses through you, where it just feels like it falls down from the sky and you're writing. That falling down from the sky is actually training yourself as a writer and a reader. So if you're just a reader of poetry, the more poetry you read, the more you understand how to read it, right? The more poetry you write, the more you understand how to write it. And it goes for other kinds of writing as well. That inspiration, this thing we call inspiration or the hunch, right? It's just really something you also train yourself. You're training yourself to be inspired. You're training yourself to, oh, I like that idea. I want to play with that idea. Oh, I'm thinking about this image, or I want to play with that image. Oh, I see something out in the world. I want to write it down and kind of think about it later, and maybe it will lead to another idea, right? You're sort of, one of the great things about building notebooks as a reader, but also as a writer, is that you can kind of work through your ideas. So sometimes it's around, you're just writing down like everything you saw on a given day, and then next day, everything else you saw, or everything you heard, or anything you read, or you're writing down phrases that you love from things you've read, like online or in other media. And those start leading to a way for your brain to start getting inspired, right? So that idea of where the hunch, so what I'm saying is that the articulation of the hunch doesn't just happen like, oh, I don't know where that came from. It actually happens because you've been training your consciousness to find what the hunch is, so that you can recognize the hunch, so that you can say, oh, that's a hunch. That's inspiring me. You can point to it. You can point to it because you've trained your mind over time to figure out what inspires you. Sometimes, what I will say about that is that you see something, a piece of art, or you listen to a piece of music, or and it just hits you, right? It just kind of overwhelms you. And you're like, oh, I'm inspired. And you don't, and maybe it's not something you're prepared for. So I would call that kind of the visionary moment. So I'll give you a short example of that. I'm sure you've had this happen to you. So I was watching a piece of online work. In this case, it was an online performance. And very recently, and suddenly it was like I was wide awake, you know, like if suddenly it was like I'm not only in another world, right, just traveling mentally to another experience, watching this thing, but I'm also recognizing something. I'm also going, wow, I don't think I've ever seen anything like this before, and it's kind of like blowing my mind open, right? That's, I think, sometimes a different way of thinking about how it's not really a hunch, but that's sometimes where what I call the lightning bolt moment or the aha moment, where you just have aha moments around things you see or experience in art and in life that then become part of your vocabulary as a thinker and a reader to apprehend how you're going to think about the word inspiration. Poets frequently spend more time working on a bad poem than on a good one. And in large measure, that's because the stronger work tends to emerge more fully formed right from the start. Often the hunch turns out to be correct. We may have to knock a while on the door of poetry, but when we are finally let inside and are in the midst of what we feel to be a real poem, we know something special is happening. And that something special has to do with a double consciousness. And that double consciousness has to do with both an engagement with a future reader. So when you're writing, sometimes you're just writing for yourself, but that's not enough, you know? Like, it's enough for you. But at a certain point in the act of writing, you're imagining somebody reading it or experiencing it. If you're writing film, you're going in your head somewhere. You're like, okay, this is for me and I'm enjoying it and that's great. And then there's this other part that happens, which is, this is for me, but I also want to communicate something to somebody else. When that starts to happen in the writing process, is when you're getting somewhere, right? You go beyond the sort of narrow, myopic, I'm just in my head and it's only for me. And you start to think about like how it may communicate. You may not know how it may land. That's not something you can control. Unless you're writing very specific genre work, like horror, for example. But the idea, just as you're writing, to be thinking about future reader, that future reader can be a friend. That future reader can be someone you love, right? That future reader can be, oh, I can't wait till I show this to so-and-so, right? That can be one of your heroes, right? You can be like, oh, my favorite lyricist, my favorite rapper, if they read this, what would they think, right? Sometimes as writers, that's how we write. And I would say that as you read work by artists, think of it through that process of writing, right? It didn't just happen fully formed. From the head of Zeus, writing happened. Everyone that you read has gone through a process. And I think as readers, starting to think about what that process might be and might have been, without doing the biography of the writer and all of that, because you know, in a way, I know there are all sorts of books that talk about the only way you'll really know is if you read what that writer was going through, and that's how you know. You know, I am a great believer in speculation when it comes to writing. And what I will say about that is as follows in terms of process. Yes, sometimes you have access to a writer's notebooks. And if you're doing the archival work, you're like, oh my gosh, you know, this writer was going through this. So therefore, when they wrote this line in their story, it means this because they were thinking about their wife or their husband or their daughter or whatever. But actually, that's not, I mean, that can be like very interesting and compelling information. I would argue that in a way, it has nothing to do with the writing itself. And what I mean by that, the reception of the writing. The writing, once it lands on the page or on the screen, becomes its own object. So the stuff that inspired it personally, from the writer's point of view, in a way is neither here nor there. So you can say, for example, I'm writing a poem about a breakup I had, right? A lot of poets, a lot of writers write about breakups. It's a big subject, very, you know, it yields a lot of feelings. It makes you want to write often. If you have that at your disposal, you know, it becomes a great tool to get through a breakup and start writing about everything you feel about it, right? If the work is to be art, if the work is to be artful, it cannot rely on somebody else's knowledge that that's what you were going through when you made the thing. Unless you're super explicit in the piece that you write, where you tell, right? Where you tell your reader or your audience, hey, this is me. This is what I was going through. And even then, I would argue that the personal once it becomes art, does become another thing, does become something outside of you that has a spirit of who you are as an artist, as a thinker, as a person, as a human being walking the earth. But it actually becomes this separate object that starts to communicate with readers, with the world at large, with strangers, right? Readers that don't know you, that will encounter the work and suddenly think, that's me. Oh, that could be me. Or, gosh, that's not me, but I'm really compelled by what I'm reading. Poet Charles Olson said that a poet caught up in the making of a genuine poem can go by no other track than the one the poem underhand declares for itself. I'm going to repeat that. It's a complicated thought, okay? Charles Olson said, a poet caught up in the making of a genuine poem can go by no other track than the one the poem underhand declares for itself. So what does this mean? It means that in the act of writing, so I'll say it this a different way, in the act of writing, there's an underlayer. And that underlayer, what some writers call the groove, right, or the flow of writing, and not the flow in terms of rhyme, but the flow in terms of the work, right? So the underlayer, the tunnel underneath the work starts to become solid. It's what we call structure, right? So that tunnel that becomes solid and starts to feel inevitable is when the poem starts to declare itself. I'll put it yet another way. Writers, when they're working on something, if they're trying to choose what form they're going to be working in, so let's say a poem, a short story, a play, for example. Sometimes they're testing different sort of ideas to see which form is best suited, right? So you're like, oh, I have an idea for something. And you're like, oh, I'll try it out as a poem. And then you work on that and you realize, oh, actually, that would work much better as a short story. Or actually, that might work better as a song. Or actually, that might work better as a play. Or, oh, definitely as a poem, right? So part of the process of writing is figuring out the necessity for that form. What does that form demand? What does poetry demand that a short story doesn't? What does a short story do that a play doesn't do? So how can you, what's the best container, in other words, for the act of writing that you're trying to make? And thinking of from this from a reader's perspective is also looking at like, oh, what, you know, I would ask when you're looking at a poem, thinking about why is it a poem? Like, what, you know, I think that's like an essential question. Why is this a poem and not a short story? Or you're looking at a short story. Why is this a short story and not a play? Why is this a play, you know, and not a song? Right? So I think that thinking about the choice of form is very significant because the form dictates something. Within the form, right, within the discipline of writing, a poet decides to write a poem. That's the best container for it. Then you have to think, what kind of poem? Is it a metered poem? Is it reverse? Is it, you know, and then we go down the line, right? The same to do with the play. Like, oh, I'm going to write a play. Well, what kind of play? Is it a tragedy? Is it a comedy? Is it right? And then you kind of start to figure out what the different forms inside the greater form are best suited to that idea. But figuring out why something is best suited for that container is really interesting. From a reader's perspective and from a writer's perspective, going through that process. In fact, something I always recommend is for you to try out ideas in different forms, just to see. Because at some point, it will tell you, right? So I'm going to say, I remember a colleague of mine was working on a poem, and long form poem, I think it was over 300 lines, just fairly long. And, you know, they said, oh, I don't know, I think maybe I'll, I'm not sure it's a poem. I think they were working on it, they were confused about that maybe they had chosen the wrong container for their idea. And so they said, I'm going to try it as a short story. So they wrote it as a short story. And as a short story, it was fine. You know what I mean? It was like effective, but something was missing. There was something about it that felt not quite right. And then in the process of writing a short story, the writer figured out, oh, actually, it really is a poem, right? So I think thinking about why you're looking at the form you're looking at, what is it doing that other forms can't do? What does it share with other forms, right? Because writing is elastic, right? And forms do share properties, emotional properties, engagements with audiences, but they do function in different ways. So I'm just going to throw that out there. Robert Frost, I mentioned Robert Frost again, only because he was sort of like a popular poet, do you know? He was someone that, for a while in the United States, was a very, very popular poet in the early 20th century. And wrote in a kind of immediate vernacular, plain spoken vernacular. Complicated ideas, but very plain spoken. And had a big audience. One of those poets that had a very big audience, which is not always true, right? For all poets. So I'm quoting from him here. Robert Frost believed that, like a piece of ice on a hot stove, the poem must ride on its own melting. I love that, right? Like a piece of ice on a hot stove, a poem must ride on its own melting. This sense that a poem is practically writing itself is one to which every experienced poet can attest. And even though the poem may ultimately need a fair amount of revision, because that's just a natural part of the process, before it's finished, getting off to a good start is a significant advantage. The word inspiration refers to the sacred revelation visited upon a person by a god. And unfortunately, that's not the sort of event that happens to us, to most of us anyway, every day. Sometimes you'll find that the muse is in the neighborhood. Bruce Springsteen, if you've seen his show, Springsteen on Broadway, or if you've read his autobiographical book, just talks about his writing process a lot, both in that show and also in his autobiography. And he has a section about the neighborhood, about growing up in Jersey, and that the beginnings of him as a writer, and he thinks of himself as a writer first and a musician second, that his beginnings as a writer had a lot to do with him wanting to write the stories of his neighborhood, right? Of wanting to kind of capture what it felt like to go down a certain block, who lived on that neighborhood, what were they doing, what were the rituals, etc. So I think that sometimes when you're trying to find inspiration, to use that word, or trying to follow your hunch, right? Sometimes you find it in a more immediate way. Or like, oh, I want to write about my neighborhood. I want to see what those stories are. If you've lived in many neighborhoods, then you have a lot of stories to tell, right? But even if you've lived in one neighborhood your whole life, there's still a lot of stories there, right? Because there's so many people. And all those family units or single units, whoever lives there, each of those houses has a story, right? And the ground upon which the neighborhood is built also has stories behind it. How did that neighborhood come to be? What were, you know, did it change demographics? What were the laws? You know, there's so many ways of parsing through a neighborhood, right? So really allowing yourself to use that as a muse is not such a bad idea. Poets, of course, have been testing themselves not only against the restrictions imposed by elaborate rhyme and metrical schemes, but also against poets that have come before them. Consider the sonnet, for instance, right? Classic form, poetry, the sonnet. Among those who have entered its field of play are some of the greatest poets writing in English, Shakespeare, Milton, Wordsworth, Keats, and more. The sonnet, the villanelle, and other types of poetry, the ghazal, the pantoum, sort of staples for poets, right? Sometimes a strict form, a metered form, is very helpful. Because when you're writing poetry, it harnesses your ideas, right? And this is equivalent to restricting, right? Walking in the wilderness, looking for your story, but also restricting the elements that you're going to be working with. And when you're working with a very strict element, like a sonnet, for instance, you're following its rules. You have to figure out, you have to do a lot of work to make it work, which is exciting. It puts you in the field of play kind of immediately. In a sense, what I'm saying is that instead of letting yourself wander endlessly in the wilderness, which is a necessary part of the writing process, and also of the reading process, and I think of these processes hand in hand, you know? Like, I think of reading and writing go together, right? So that as a reader, the more you read, right, you're kind of in the wilderness of reading. The more you read, the more you have access to different kinds of vocabularies and different ways of seeing and the many different kinds of stories and ways of telling stories that are possible, right? So that's very exciting because it means that your world gets bigger, right? It's all about getting your world getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But looking at a specific form sometimes allows you to kind of be very, to solve creative problems in a compelling way. And so I just want to put that out there. You know, for some people, entering the world of forms is comforting, right? So thinking about literature and introducing yourself to literature and, oh my gosh, literature, what is it? You know, we're exposed to all kinds of literature all the time, right? There's, you know, more prosaic literature, like the language of a driver's handbook, right? Or a recipe for baking a cake or, you know, I mean, there's language that we're surrounded by, right, and on an everyday level that is formal, right, you know, that has, you know, codes and structures around it. But sometimes we don't think of it as writing, you know, we don't think that, oh, that's actually writing that we're, and even a lot of the work that I think we read online, let's say in the news. People say, I'm reading the news. Well, actually what you're doing is you're reading a journalist telling you the news, right? Unless it's just a list of facts. If you're reading a news item, if you're reading a story, you're reading a journalist's take on that story. You know, and they're being as accurate as humanly possible, and they're, you know, they have a responsibility to their material, but you are reading it through the lens of a writer, right? So it's not devoid of kind of point of view. It's not found writing. In other words, it's not just lying in the street. You pick it up and you read it. It actually comes from somewhere. So that's why I say that reading and writing go together, because it's this idea of you are surrounded by writing all the time. And then it's like, how much different kinds of writing do you expose yourself to? And I would, you know, I would argue I work in the world often of poetry, but I usually work in the world of poetry that is theater, poetry that is film, and poetry that is opera. And what I will say about that is that in film, television, film, visual storytelling mediums, such as those, which have historically been around for a very short time, right? So we think of the stream of history, oral writing, if somebody standing up and telling a story is the oldest form of writing, right? If somebody speaking their story is a form of writing. Then came that act written down on a page somewhere. So the act of codifying, excuse me, the spoken word. So the first thing that ever happened was spoken word. spoken word in plays, right? Because plays are spoken poems, right? So spoken word happened, and then somebody said, let's write it down. And then it was like, oh, somebody else said in the course of history, oh, let's print that. So not let's just write it down, but then let's print it so that more people can read it. And so we can sell it, right? So then there's that whole chain of going from the person standing up telling their story to then that story being written, then that story being printed, then that story being reproduced, right? That chain leads us to the world eventually of the visual story, right? Which is, which we now see, right? Film and television. And streaming. Streaming, which is film and television, basically, right? It's using the same elements. And we're exposed to so many stories in film and television. I mean, just story after story after story after story. Many different kinds of ways of seeing by different filmmakers, showrunners. But at the end of the day, that's still, you're still reading. It's visual reading. And what you're reading, I think, in a film and in streaming and TV, and I'm speaking strictly about fictional work, and documentaries are kind of off to the side for a little second, but fictional work, series, movies, so forth, you're reading visually, which means you're not only thinking about what people say, but how a scene is set, what is the visual composition of each frame, what is the use of color, what is the use of light. So aspects that I think maybe, I don't want to presume, but I think aspects that when people, let's say, read a novel, I'm just going to say that kind of casually, sometimes you're not thinking about very consciously, like, oh, I wonder what the visual composition is of this scene. You know, unless the novelist is telling you, that may or may not enter the picture. It may be like a mental image that you have while you're reading, but it may not be given to you. So I think that one of the fascinating aspects of visual storytelling is you actually have to do more work But the illusion behind it is that you're having to do less, right? Because I think what most people do when they see a film or a series is that they're thinking about the plot or the characters or both, right? Plot and character, right? But actually, those are just elements. They're strong elements for sure, right? But there's also like, how is it composed, frame to frame? Why is the color scheme the way it is? What are the costumes like? What is the lighting doing? Why does the lighting make you feel a certain way? What is the sort of place setting, right? So the idea of geographical space or interior spaces that are designed. How are we invited into those spaces as readers, as visual readers? What is that saying to us? How is it informing how we feel, right? That's an act of reading. So I'm just going to put that out there. You may already be drawn to a certain type of formalism, the regular metrical rhythm, the perfect rhyme that people associate with poetry. For much of the history of poetry written in English, meter and to a lesser extent rhyme were considered fundamental. Whether poets such as Gail White would consider themselves new formalists, this was a label given to those working in meter and rhyme in the 1980s. If you imagine, in the 1980s in poetry, there was a reaction against free verse, and you had a whole wave of poets that started that called themselves new formalists, right? They wanted to work with metered forms, and valuing the traditional elements of verse. The etymology of the word poetry suggests a poet is one who arranges thoughts and images in an artful way. I'm going to say it again. A poet is one who arranges thoughts and images in an artful way. From this perspective, the poet is a kind of architect, an artisan. Like an apprentice furniture maker, poets working in forms must study carefully, practice hard, be prepared for their early efforts to not be so good, which is fine. A good chair is really hard to make until you've made a ton of chairs. Right. Poetry, of course, can also be written in free verse. We know this. From the 17th century translators of the King James Bible, many of whom were poets, by the way, to the 19th century American innovator Walt Whitman, an effort has long been underway to capture the power of poetry without having to adhere to strict metrical patterns or rhyme schemes. Drawing on the examples of writers such as T.S. Eliot and William Carlos Williams, 20th century poets turned more and more frequently to free verse. And today, of course, poetry written in free verse is the norm rather than the exception. In fact, when you find a poet today writing in a metered form, people are shocked. They're like, what? What are you doing? Meter? Oh, my heavens. But actually, people do use it. If it doesn't rhyme, and this is just like a funny aside, right? So, if it doesn't rhyme and you think it's a poem but aren't sure what to call it, it's probably free verse, right? Like poets working in forms and in free verse, experimental avant-garde or postmodern poets are a part also of a long tradition, but that tradition may not be as easy to pin down. This is a tradition in free verse that deals with rhythm, repetition, and rhyme. Or conventional expectations of what a poem should do. If you've ever been to a poetry slam, you have been exposed to spoken word or performance poetry. So it's not so far. It's not so far off the realm. Consciousness. I'll leave it at that for today because I feel like we've gone through so much, and I also don't want to overwhelm you. But yeah. So this is think of this as a chapter one in a way. The first take on thinking about writing and poetry and reading and reception and other forms and how we encounter them. Great. Thanks for listening.